Good day and welcome to Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Kate Harner. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for calling in to Cigna's 2013 Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you'll be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback on your experience in today's seminar. After this survey, you will be able to ask questions of today's speaker. A handout for today's presentation is available online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page, under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Eating Disorders, an Addictive or Psychiatric Illness. Once again, visit the Awareness Series page online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page, under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Eating Disorder, an Addictive or Psychiatric Illness. Please also notice the blue square in the top section of the page that you may click on to sign up for future seminars. It's not required that you sign up in order to attend the monthly seminars. However, if you choose to do so, you will receive an email reminder for each month's presentation. Please note that the educational series will be on break through the remainder of 2013, but will resume on January 28, 2014. We will have monthly sessions on the fourth Tuesday of each month from January through October of 2014. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Marty Lerner. Dr. Lerner is the Executive Director of Milestones in Recovery, and today he will be sharing information with us on the addiction aspects of eating disorders. Welcome, Dr. Lerner.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you for having me, and good afternoon to everybody who's participating. Hopefully, you all have been able to find the link to the slides. And as we go through the slides, I'll reference where we are in terms of the talking points and corresponding slides. So assuming that you're there, the first slide after the title on top will say Part 1, the Addiction Viewpoint. So just to give you an overview of what I hope to be addressing and talking about today is the case for looking at eating disorders, which include the whole gamut of disorders, anorexia, bulimia, binge eating disorder, and whatever phrases you're familiar with that refer to these, compulsive overeating, bulimorexia, etc., looking at them from the perspective of being an addictive process, very similar in many ways and distinctly different in some ways from other addictions, such as alcohol dependency, drug dependency, and what sometimes are called process addictions, which are not substance addictions but behavioral addictions like compulsive gambling, sex addiction, compulsive spending, and the like. So we're going to look at each eating disorder through that prism or that set of perspective. And so it begs the question, does an addictions model or how we define an addiction really apply to anorexia, to bulimia, to binge eating, and so forth? And, of course, a question I'm often asked is, well, how can food be addictive? And we hopefully can address and respond to that question, as well as what related problems frequently accompany an eating disorder, because usually the majority of people that suffer and struggle with eating disorders also struggle with other problems that are related or accompany an eating disorder, such as mood disorders or chemical dependencies or other process addictions. And then lastly, what is the psychiatric treatment for an eating disorder? What's the addictions model treatment for an eating disorder, and how do you blend these models to meet the needs of what is a very complex presentation when people come for help with an eating disorder? So if you go to the next slide, it is titled American Psychiatric Association, Symptoms of an Addiction. Let me set the stage for what we're going to be talking about or looking at on this slide in particular. The American Psychiatric Association used to differentiate or separate addictions. So they would have a set of criteria for alcohol abuse or dependency, a separate set of criteria for, let's say, cocaine dependency, abuse or addiction, and opiate addiction, and so on and so forth. More recently, they consolidated all these different chemical or substance addictions and came up with a list of seven criteria or symptoms or descriptors that define what an addiction is, be that alcohol dependency, cocaine dependency, opiate dependency, or what have you. And in some instances have also combined looking at process addictions for having the same set of criteria, whether it's a compulsive gambler or an alcoholic. So although they didn't intend to apply these in the beginning to an eating disorder, if you look at each of the eating disorders, whether that's a restricting pattern or relationship with food, such as what you would find with someone who cannot stop dieting or pursues losing weight and has a diagnosis of anorexia, or someone that binge eats but also compensates for that by making themselves sick or abusing laxatives or diuretics, or someone who simply binge eats, you'll see that these criteria usually will fit amongst the eating disorder population. So I just want to go through them very briefly so we can make the case for at least acknowledging that the shoe fits when you apply these to an eating disorder. The first is tolerance. Easy enough to understand, tolerance with alcohol and drugs simply means you need more of the same substance to gain the same effect over time, that the body and the mind builds up a need for more in order to get the same effect. So you look at an eating disorder and you could say perhaps that the more someone loses weight, the more they need to lose in order to feel good. And if you looked at it in terms of someone who maybe suffers with bulimia or binging and purging, they may start out doing that once or twice and with a certain amount of food or voracity. And over time, the frequency and the amount of binging and purging have to increase in order to gain the same effect. And likewise with binge eating, more food to gain the same effect. Withdrawal is another symptom of a dependency or addiction. With eating disorders, we see both physical and psychological withdrawal symptoms, although more subtle than you would think to find with opiates or alcohol. There are certainly some subtle physical symptoms of withdrawal, especially from offending substances that are usually high glycemic foods like sugar, flour, or junk food. And psychological, most patients report feeling as if they are missing the one thing that was rewarding in their life when you take away the ability to either restrict, lose weight, binge, purge, etc. More for longer periods than intended, sort of self-explanatory. Most people start out with the intention of limiting the amount of weight they lose, limiting the frequency or the amount of food they overeat, and the time and energy involved, and of course end up where they're spending more time and energy than intended. Anybody that's dieted to excess can relate to the unsuccessful effort to cut back or control. With no exception that I can think of have I seen someone coming for at least a higher level of care treatment with an eating disorder that hasn't attempted dozens of different ways to either cut back or limit their control over their eating disorder. Significant time to obtain or recover from effects, decreased activities due to dependency, which is basically isolating and no longer doing the things that someone might have enjoyed doing in the past, particularly social. People with addictions, including eating disorders, towards the end stage of that process tend to isolate or have few friends or social contacts. And last, the continuation of the addiction or the behavior despite consequences. The interesting thing about this before we move on is the American Psychiatric Association, at least this Committee on Dependency, set the criterion for defining a dependency is not all seven, not six, not five, not four, but just needing three of these characteristics to qualify for a diagnosis of dependency. As a side note, whenever I polled the patients that have attended milestones for treatment of their eating disorder, the mean or average symptoms or criteria that people will admit to are usually about six. If you move to the next slide, the question becomes, well, how can food or dieting be addictive? Let me say that when you look at addiction, it's sort of like a perfect storm. It's a combination of the nature of the person and the nature of the substance. If I can borrow from an analogy with alcohol, alcohol in and of itself is not a bad substance, but it is potentially addictive when it's combined with a person who's predisposed either biochemically or psychologically or both towards abusing alcohol. So it takes the nature of the substance in combination with the nature of the person and looking at amount and frequency and length of time for both physical and psychological dependency to take place. Likewise, not everybody that diets becomes anorectic. Not everybody that overeats becomes bulimic or a binge eater. So there has to be some mix between the nature of the person or predisposition and the nature of the behavior and the substance. We're also going to discuss the more recent research, which demonstrates that really addictions, including eating disorders and all the flavors of eating disorders, are really a brain disease. And looking at the brain chemistry, at the chemicals that are responsible for modulating and controlling our moods, whether we feel good or feel bad, those chemistries and structures are significantly different when you look or compare someone who does not have an addiction or eating disorder and someone who does. Of course, the debate is that acquired by constantly abusing food or abusing dieting, et cetera, and does that develop as a result of that, or is that a predisposition that predates the onset of the addiction or the eating disorder? But we do know that when we compare people through MRI imaging, which I'll show you in a moment, that you can graphically see differences in the brain chemistry of someone with anorexia, bulimia, compulsive overeating, and someone who does not have either an eating disorder or other addiction. The other piece to keep in mind is the research has long shown us that although it may be dose and frequency dependent, junk foods, most notably very highly processed foods like sugar, white flour, corn syrup, a derivative of sugar, and so on, have addictive properties. Again, it's the nature of the substance can be addicting, but when combined with the nature of the person who may have a predisposition, there is a physiological dependency that can develop to certain types of foods. So we'll also talk about which foods in particular, but basically they come in the category of very highly processed junk foods. You can visualize that by walking through your grocery store and noting that about 90% of what's sold there, you know, in the cereal and other aisles are very highly processed, high glycemic foods, and that most of what you would be eating if this were 100 years ago is really in the periphery of the grocery store, which are namely whole foods that aren't highly processed foods. The other is looking at restricting, because it's not an overconsumption illness. Restricting with anorexia is also very addicting, psychologically and physiologically, which we'll talk about. Although at the other end of the continuum from overeating or overeating and compensating, restricting or anorexia is quite addictive, both from a brain chemistry perspective and also from a psychological perspective. If you go to the next slide, the next part of this is looking at the physical aspect, as I was alluding to, of addiction or brain chemistry. We're going to look at what the research is showing us. As I had spoken about, identify the offending substances. And then lastly, as a comment I would make about the genetic link, if there is any, with eating disorders, the research is suggesting that there may be a genetic predisposition to both alcoholism, drug addiction, as well as eating disorders, but correlation in research does not always mean it's the cause. It again means that there may be a vulnerability or weakness or predisposition. So the nature of the person may be predisposed towards an eating disorder, but it also has to combine with a set of behaviors and or a substance in order for that to evolve as a distinct eating disorder. So let's take a look at something. This is an MRI image or tomography of the human brain. And what we're looking at are four distinct individuals. And in the left upper corner, you're seeing a normal brain. And what we're looking at is a concentration of a chemical called dopamine. What's important to know is that the more that chemical is concentrated in the brain and the more receptors that there are to receive that, the more rewarded or the more normal or the more serene that person feels. So that person may be relaxing, watching TV, or with someone they care about, or watching a movie, is feeling rewarded. The brain next to that brain on the right, although it's referenced as a brain of an obese person, it's really the brain identical to someone with bulimia, anorexia, or binge eating disorder. It just happens that this slide they used as someone who was overweight, which, as a side comment, to me is more a symptom of some eating disorders, but certainly, or an effect of an eating disorder, and might be more prone to looking at someone with bulimia or compulsive overeating, but certainly would also be similar to someone with anorexia. The point being that you'll see very little red area in this, and the red is this concentration of dopamine. So the translation when you're looking or reading this MRI is that this person, while watching a movie or having a meal or doing any of the normal activities that someone without an addiction or eating disorder would normally enjoy, is dysphoric or unable to experience reward or something positive from that experience, because they have not regenerated and or destroyed some of the receptors or structure of the brain that's responsible for allowing a concentration of this feel-good chemical, dopamine, to exist. In other words, tolerance sets in where in the beginning this person would get a flood of the red like you would see in the left picture. After a while, they would have to eat more and more and more, or they would have to restrict more and more and more to be able to feel normal, let alone good. So they've destroyed, or it's really called downregulated, not regenerated, the dopamine receptors. It's very similar to what you see with cocaine addicts. After a while, or even after they stop using cocaine, they will feel very depressed or unable to enjoy things that most people ordinarily would sense as rewarding, because the chemicals are not there in order to function that way. And it's the same thing with alcohol dependency. You can see a little bit of red, but for the most part, most alcoholics have to drink more and more and more to get the same effect, and after a while, it's not working any longer, so most alcoholics are experiencing irritability, restlessness, dysphoria, boredom, and generally just feeling lousy. So the color match, red is for dopamine. The yellow is just a medium amount of dopamine or a slight amount. And the green is about the lowest you can get. So for eating disorders, there's a fair amount of green, but there's quite a bit of diminished dopamine availability. If you look at the next slide, you'll see what we call D2 receptors or dopamine receptors. The easiest way to explain this is if you looked at a receptor in the brain, it's really like a lock. And the chemical dopamine, the feel-good chemical, is like a key. In order for the chemical to make you feel good, it has to fit into a lock and unlock the dopamine into the brain. The problem is that as you build tolerance through restricting or binging and purging and so on and so forth, or if you build tolerance to abusing a drug or alcohol, what ends up happening is you destroy or minimize the number of locks, so you have a bunch of keys with nowhere to go. So basically, the dopamine may be available in the brain, but it's not available to do its work in terms of normalizing or stabilizing someone's mood. And the slide just kind of demonstrates on the left normal concentrations of dopamine in what's called control subjects or people that don't have these issues. And then on the right side, the brains of folks and MRI images that are addicted to various substances, all of which have in common dysphoria or feeling depressed and not having much dopamine that they can do much with. It takes a long time for those receptors to regenerate. They do in recovery with abstinence from the offending substances or the offending behavior, so that whether it's 6 months, a year, or whatever from that point forward, the brain restores itself back to health. However, it can quickly fall backwards into that scheme with a resumption of the addiction. The next slide is just another presentation graphically of how this all works. So if we took, for instance, a binge eating disorder or bulimia, in the beginning it works to either fix feelings or to numb feelings that may be negative. It results in some urges or cravings to consume either more food or to increase the frequency of binging and purging or to lose more weight. The behavior, whether it's binging or restricting, escalates, and the more you do it, the less pleasure you experience, and the stronger the urges or the cravings are to try to restore the original feeling or recapture the positive experience in beginning stage addiction. I would say it this way to you, and that is that all addictions have in common, including anorexia, bulimia, and compulsive overeating, a beginning, a middle, and an end stage. In the beginning stage, it works. It's really like a Burger King disease. You can have your cake and eat it. You're losing weight, perhaps, and you're feeling good, almost euphoric about that. Perhaps you're binge eating and then compensating through exercise, through using diuretics or making yourself ill, and getting rid of the food and feeling, you know, you're getting away with being able to have all the pleasure of the food without the consequence of weight gain. Or you may be overeating but not conscious or self-conscious of gaining weight and enjoying the pleasure of the food. And in middle stage, you're starting to experience some consequences, but not every time you're engaged in the behavior or ingesting the substance and whatever. But in end stage, which is where we see most people seeking treatment, it's no longer working. So people are restricting, they're binging and purging, or they're binging in an effort to gain what they had in early stage, but in reality, they're doing this just to break even, meaning they're not getting what they want, but they're avoiding the pain of withdrawal. So in the end, it's just to avoid pain. It's not to be able to feel rewarded. And what you're seeing graphically is the neurochemistry that explains that feeling. If you look at the next slide, the emotional aspects of eating disorders, you know, one of the things we talked about is it's very rare for an eating disorder to not be accompanied, whether it's chicken or the egg or whether these issues predate the eating disorder. Nonetheless, the overwhelming majority of people with eating disorders have co-occurring problems, and these need to be addressed, not necessarily as addictions, but treated at the same time from more the psychiatric perspective or psychological perspective. So you're really approaching the eating disorder from an addictions perspective, but you're also approaching the co-occurring problems from a psychiatric perspective. So we like to refer to this as a blended model, which is what we do at Milestones. So to give you a feel for what we're dealing with eating disorders across the board, I would say that at least 70, if not 90% of the folks that present with an eating disorder to at least the higher levels of care as well as outpatient suffer with mood disorders. So that includes depression, anxiety, and what's called bipolar disorder, or aberrations and vacillating between feeling too good or feeling too bad. About 40 to 60%, and at Milestones is as high as 75%, also have co-occurring issues with substance abuse, either alcohol, street, or prescription drugs, which would make sense if substance abuse is a dependency or addiction. Then if you stop using or abusing alcohol and drugs, it's not unusual to start self-medicating, even more so with your eating disorder. And conversely, if you have an eating disorder and you're no longer self-medicating, either through restricting, binging, purging, and what have you, exacerbating a pre-existing use of alcohol might, for instance, change from a use to abuse to dependency. A sidebar with all of this is that the research is showing that gastric bypass patients who are compulsive overeaters develop late-onset alcohol dependency, and the theory behind that in part is that if they're no longer anatomically able to overeat, they're finding another way of self-medicating through cross-addiction and develop a co-occurring issue with abusing alcohol. Trauma, PTSD, seems to correlate with eating disorders. Perhaps 20 to 40% of people coming in for treatment with an eating disorder, and more so with bulimia and anorexia than compulsive overeating, seem to have had some type of either physical or sexual or emotional trauma that they identify prior to the onset of their eating disorder. Attention deficit disorder. Although some estimates are higher than 30%, I suspect this is over-diagnosed as a editorial comment, and the reason being that the treatment for attention deficit disorder are some powerful prescription medications that also have appetite-suppressing properties. So most of the people that we come across that claim to have attention deficit disorder have an investment in that diagnosis because a benefit of having that, at least in the past, has been they're taking medication that, if they do have attention deficit disorder, is appropriate and sedating, but if they don't, the medication will act upon them to decrease their appetite, or in street language, it's speed. Matter of fact, one popular medication called Adderall, which we'll talk about in a moment, has been abused by both the eating disorder population and substance abuse population because it mimics methamphetamine, diapills, and so on and so forth. Personality disorders, about 20 to 40%, which sometimes is referred to borderline personality or compulsive personality or perfectionistic personality, is part and parcel of many people with eating disorders. And process addictions, which I alluded to before, are more behavioral, compulsive spending, gambling, sex addiction. And these other addictions will become more prominent when someone is no longer engaged in the eating disorder, as these take center stage and need to be addressed as just another form of self-medicating. I sometimes refer to that as changing deck chairs on the Titanic. Even within the eating disorder realm, many people will want to give up purging as a component of their bulimia to be better at restricting or changing one form of an eating disorder for another. The coexisting addictions or substances that we often see, as I mentioned, is Adderall or diet pills. The others are tranquilizers or prescription pills like Xanax, Ativan, Klonopin, and also opiates or pain medications. Our facilities in South Florida, and there's a modeling industry in South Beach, and opiates are very popular appetite suppressants amongst models. So believe it or not, opiates can be abused, both in terms of the qualities of the opiate, but also it'll be attractive to some people for its appetite-suppressing qualities. Laxatives are very common, although it's not real body weight that someone's losing. It's more water retention and dehydration that occurs. But laxatives like Correctol, Ducalax, are very common addictions or dependencies with this population. And at times, Ipecac, which is used by poison control to induce vomiting. Other ways of compensating for overeating or to expedite weight loss can be over-exercising. And, of course, street drugs, which we mentioned, cocaine, marijuana, and heroin. And last but certainly not least, alcohol and tobacco products. Another side a comment I would make is it's very hard to get people who are addicted to tobacco products, in particular cigarette smoking, to give up or abstain, because within the eating disorder population, more than other addiction population, there's the fear of weight gain. So a lot of times the use of tobacco products will increase when someone is no longer engaged in the eating disorder, as a way to self-medicate even more, but the resistance to abstaining from cigarette smoking or use of tobacco products has a lot to do with the fear of weight gain. When we use a blended addiction treatment model, as I alluded to, we're really trying to address the co-occurring issues we just spoke about, as well as directly intervene on the eating disorder, with the goal being abstinence from eating disorder behaviors. But when you look at a blended model, these are the chief components that you have to consider. It assumes that an eating disorder is an addictive process, as I had spoken about, with physical, emotional, and spiritual components. Spiritual, not to go into a long-winded definition, but basically does not necessarily equate with religious, although it can. It's vaguely defined, but basically has to do with finding a sense of purpose beyond the self-focus and self-consciousness inherent in an eating disorder. So the three components we like to look at are the physical component and what needs to be done to heal that, the emotional components, as well as the mood components, and also a sense of purpose or spiritual components. Also with a blended model, it assumes that we're looking at a disease where there's a predisposition, but also it's lifelong. It's not a cure. It's not a treatment and someone is all better. Someone can have lifelong periods of remission, or they can have long periods of remission or short periods of remission, but we don't define treatment with the end game being cure, but more long-term recovery, which is synonymous with saying long-term remission. Also, blended models incorporate traditional psychiatric and psychological therapies, and these can include nutritional therapies, medication, relevant 12-step support groups, things that are evidence-based treatment modalities, sometimes referred to as cognitive behavioral therapies or dialectical behavior therapies, and so on and so forth. But certainly using these as tools within the realm of treatment is part of what a blended model is. In the next slide, I'll say treatment setting. Something to keep in perspective is that one size doesn't fit all when you look at an eating disorder, neither in terms of treatment approach, but also what's the setting. The most intrusive or acute setting, of course, is a hospital-based setting, which is inpatient. And usually if someone is medically compromised, either significantly underweight or having medical complications from their eating disorder, that setting would be the most appropriate. Most patients with eating disorders do not require that type of intervention. Another level of care, which I would say is a lower level of care, is residential, which is what our program is at Milestones. It's non-hospital-based. Residential provides 24/7 supervision and support. It does have physicians, nurses, uses all the accoutrements of a hospital-based program, but doesn't require as restrictive as an environment and doesn't require 24/7 medical supervision per se. It's a lower level of care and affords an opportunity for patients to put into practice some daily living skills put into practice recovery skills, and can be, if handled correctly, a rather seamless transition from that level of care to lower levels of care. We like to say at our program that the last day with which someone is in our program and the next day when they transition back home or to a lower level of care, it should be seamless. So I guess the way I would frame that is inpatient is feeding someone a fish, so to speak, and residential would be teaching someone how to fish or to be self-sufficient. Partial hospitalization is a variant of residential. It's structured day treatment. So most of what you're doing in residential is there, but without a 24/7 support and supervision and without a therapeutic community day and night. Partial hospitalization can be a great transition from a higher level of care, or it can be an entry point for people seeking treatment for an eating disorder who did not require or need evening supervision and support. Intensive outpatient is usually half-day treatment and almost identical to partial hospital, except it's half-day and allows for an even less restrictive environment and more opportunities to put into practice what someone is doing in the treatment paradigm. An outpatient is usually seeing someone either once, twice, or whatever times a week, one-on-one, counseling or therapy. Sometimes it's also with a dietitian, but it is living at home, as is intensive outpatient and partial, but attending formal treatment anywhere from 1 to 3 hours per week. So it's the least intrusive level of care. Very often people are invited to use the least intrusive, and if outpatient is not affecting change or only resulting in partial remission, one can look towards climbing the ladder until they find the appropriate level of care with the desired result. Let me just say that treatment components of a blended model include the following, which is the next slide. We use a structured food plan to eliminate what we'll call trigger foods, but really high glycemic junk foods. Whether someone maintains that food plan or not will depend on the outcome and their own decisions over time. But basically, it is different than an intuitive eating or teaching people to pay attention to internal cues to determine when to eat, how to eat, and how much to eat. Our assumption is that people with eating disorders have a disturbed ability or compromised ability to make appropriate judgments about meal planning and food, and therefore we structure that for them with their choices within the boundaries of healthy eating. So basically, a structured food plan allows someone the freedom of having some support and structure around their food, both in terms of what they're eating, how much they're eating, and when they're eating, and then over time allows them to make more choices themselves as they regain control over their eating pattern. Cognitive behavioral therapies, harm reduction, these are all modalities of therapy. We use a model or philosophy in treatment that basically is saying to patients that they're responsible for their recovery. I'm simplifying this, but basically to take the onus of trying to control their eating disorder themselves with the help of ownership of responsibility rather than family, friends, et cetera, trying to control their eating disorder for them. So it's the credo of you're responsible for what you do no matter how you're feeling. We, as mentioned, treat people with co-occurring problems, which is the majority of people with eating disorders. It's of paramount importance that in a residential setting there be a therapeutic environment. And the way that that's accomplished, at least at Milestones, is we only admit people who voluntarily want to be there and through their actions are demonstrating a sincere desire to want to recover. So we're not the type of program, nor do I think most residential programs, are suited for people who are totally resistant and not ready to participate in their own recovery. We use community-based support groups, mostly 12-step-oriented programs like Overeaters Anonymous, Anorectic and Bulimics Anonymous, and variants of those groups. We do see a role for medication, but we don't view medication as the magic bullet. It is a tool. And you can see that mindful eating, or basically making sure that people are focused on what they're doing around the food, and also very practical daily living skills, such as preparing their own meals, going grocery shopping, at first under the supervision of a dietitian, and so on, are very important in the therapy process. And we individualize family therapy because each family can be somewhat different. So we don't do a family group per se where one size fits all with the family. We're going to go short on time. I'll just say that on structured food plans, we use a dietitian who's familiar with our model of treatment and eating disorders. It often involves weighing and measuring food rather than taking body weight measurements. We schedule eating to be small but frequent meals, usually 3 to 5 times daily. As I said, we limit high glycemic or junk foods, and we do blind weights and do not weigh people so that they're focused on their body weight, but more focused on what they're doing around the food. And lastly, we summarize the treatment philosophy as having kind of an acronym of components called SURF, which stands for the four basic components, which are spirituality, exercise, rest, and a food plan. And we individualize these for the population we serve. The criticism or concerns about our model, to be fair, we do not offer a cure. Our philosophy is that it requires a long-term commitment to recovery. It usually involves a structured food plan, and it limits or eliminates binge foods. We don't teach people how to handle brownies and junk foods. The belief is that they may be able to do that in a structured setting, but over time, it's very similar in our minds to asking an alcoholic to do controlled drinking. So that might be more controversial, but nonetheless, that is our experience. And our model isn't for everybody. Some, but not all, restricting anorectics with no history of addictive behaviors or co-occurring issues may not be suitable for this model. They may be suitable for more of a ad-lib model with eating and a different approach. And this model recognizes the need to treat cross addictions, and we tend to attract people that have multiple issues, but about, as I said, half to three-quarters of our population have co-occurring substance abuse issues. The last slide is just a list of resources that we suggest. There are meetings and lists for support. Not to confuse, treatment is different than support groups, so we use community-based support groups to augment the recovery treatment that we offer. And last, we also have a guidebook to eating disorders recovery that you can download at either iBooks, or you can email us for a free copy. That's basically the presentation. I could probably talk for hours more, but nonetheless, that pretty much is a broad stroke portrait of how we view eating disorders and how we treat them. And at this point, I'm going to turn our conversation open to you all to ask some questions and probably conclude at the top of the hour, but invite you to either email or contact us through Cigna if you desire a copy of our guidebook or would have any questions that go beyond the hour that we're spending together. So thank you very much for your attention and listening, and I'll turn it back over to Kate.
Okay, and actually we'll have Matt go ahead and do some survey questions at this point.
Sure.
Thank you, ma'am. And to help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you're a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After I finish reading the entire question, all the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is off to allow your signal to reach your equipment. After the last question, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Question 1. This session provided me with a better understanding of how eating disorders could be considered an addiction. That is star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, and star 4 for strongly disagree. Again, question 1, this session provided me with a better understanding of how eating disorders could be considered an addiction. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, and star 4 for strongly disagree. Question 2. This session educated me on the pros and cons of blending addiction treatment model. That is star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, star 4 for strongly disagree. Again, question 2. This session educated me on the pros and cons of a blended addiction treatment model. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, star 4 for strongly disagree. Question 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, and star 4 for strongly disagree. Again, question 3 is, overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 for disagree, star 4 for strongly disagree. Question 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 if you agree, star 2 if you disagree. Again, question 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 for your agreement, and star 2 if you do not agree. Question 5. Please select one of the responses that best describe your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. Star 4, other. The in question 5 is, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. And Star 4, other. And thank you, everybody, for participating in our survey. At this time, if you'd like to signal for a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, that is star 1 to signal, and please be sure that your mute function is off to allow that signal to reach our equipment. And again, if you do have a question for the doctor at this time, please press star 1. And we have no questions at this time. I'd like to turn the call back to Kate Harner. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, everyone, for attending, and a special thank you to Dr. Marty Lerner for providing such wonderful insights today. If anyone listening has specific questions for anyone at Cigna, please feel free to call the number on the back of your insurance card and ask to be connected with the eating disorder team. Once again, please remember that this was our final Eating Disorder Awareness presentation for 2013, and the seminar series will resume on the fourth Tuesday of every month, beginning on January 28, 2014. Thanks so much, everyone. Have a great day.
And once again, that does conclude today's call. Thank you for your participation.